Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
Hey, I'm Rob Riggle.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Shane Mitchell.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff Probst, and you're listening to The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Gardner.
Todd Ghana.
What a combination.
I am a huge fan of documentaries. If you look at my Netflix queue, probably more than anything that I binge are just all of the different documentary series they have. I've been a member of the Academy probably for 10 years, and around awards time, they always send out all the documentaries on DVD, and I devour all of them. I am just a huge, huge nerd for everything documentary. But I have no idea how to make one, how to get it financed, how to market one. I'm just a complete neophyte at the business of being a documentary filmmaker. And so when my friend Ricky Lake had her documentary coming out, I wanted to bring her on not just to talk about her insanely huge, remarkable career, which spans from 1988 when she was, you know, Tracy Turnblad in Hairspray, to being a talk show host, to being an Emmy Award winner, to being on Dancing with the Stars, et cetera, et cetera. But I wanted to talk to her and her partner, Abby Epstein, about the making of documentaries. Abby has directed a number of really remarkable documentaries, and her and Ricky Lake have partnered on a bunch together. They're really experts on how to get these things made. Now, they won't say they're experts. They think they're still beginners at it, but, you know, they've made remarkable documentaries. I just wanted to kind of deep dive into how do you come up with the idea? How do you actually make a documentary, i.e. shoot it, edit it, get it financed, and then what are your options to get distribution for these things? So we have a pretty deep dive into this and other topics. I hope you enjoy. All right. We're here with Ricky Lake and Abby Epstein. Hi, Ricky.
Hi.
Hi, Abby. So Ricky and I have known each other a long time, just tangentially in the business, but we really bonded at the summit event in
February.
In February in the snow. Mm-hmm. And since then, you've been on this like really like whirlwind. You said you were going to go on this whirlwind Say Yes to Everything tour.
Is that what I said?
Yep, you did. And you've been, and so then I've been reading, well, first of all, I know you went to Burning Man.
Yes.
Because you went with a friend, you were in a camp mm-hmm. with a friend of mine. And then you've been doing some ayahuasca because you talked about that. So mm-hmm. you've kind of been doing everything. You've been like yeah. really exploring, you've been doing plant medicine and exploring your life and opening yourself up to new experiences. That's
correct.
Great.
I have. I've been
great.
Doing ayahuasca. I did for the first time, I think, in 2013.
Oh, okay.
And I've done
so
it
you're a veteran
more
with
than
that.
10 times.
Awesome.
Yeah. Veteran? Does that make me? I don't think you're ever
I think
a veteran.
If you do it more than once, you're a veteran.
okay.
right?
You've done it. Yes? You've done it?
No. God, no.
Oh.
Here's the thing. Because they say that you purge all the negative stuff, and most – then I would dissolve like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Well,
I would purge everything. That's all. I'm built on that.
I had a difficult time purging, actually. My body does not give up a calorie easily.
That's very funny. So you guys – well, Ricky, you have had such an incredible career – since 1988, being in Hairspray.
Yeah. Thank
you. You've been a talk show host. You've been on Dancing with the Stars. You've been came in sixth in Poker Stars.
Fifth.
You're good at everything.
No, that's not true.
It is
that's
true.
Not true. But I love reinventing myself. That's one of the things I really, really I get a rise out of is like proving myself in other areas. You know, flipping the way people see me.
And what was your first love? Like, when did you first – was there anything that inspired you early, like a movie or a mm-hmm. TV show or something that inspired you to start this career?
Annie. Oh, this career? Oh, documentary
film? No. Just this career that you're
career,
on.
My career. As a little girl,
Annie?
Seeing Broadway, my grandmother used to take – I grew up outside of New York mm-hmm. City. And so every weekend, as I can remember, she took me – I mean, Pirates of Penzance when I was like 4 or 5 years old.
On Broadway.
Mm-hmm. On Broadway, wherever it was playing in
okay.
Manhattan.
Sure.
Yeah. Seeing Annie. I saw Grease. You know, it was just being exposed to performing, live performing. And I was a singer. And I loved the idea of all eyes on me.
Oh.
Like me winning over a crowd. And mm-hmm. whether it was – performing, singing or dancing. I thought I had the goods back then. My mother didn't think so. My grandmother did. My grandmother instilled in me that I was the best, that I was the most talented, that I was the most special. And luckily that confidence stayed with me.
That's so great.
It was great.
And so did you start in theater before you got Hairspray? How did you get Hairspray?
Singing. Okay, so I was singing in New York in like an off-Broadway troupe that I don't even know if you knew about, Abby, when you were little. It was called The Early Show. It was this very successful, very like local. Uh-huh. But it was every weekend, every Saturday. I joined it when I was about 14 years old, and I would sing, like really like sexy. So I was this chubby, awkward girl with braces, and I would sing like Where the Boys Are, you know, and belt it out. And I loved it. It was in New York. It was called Don't Tell Mama on 46th Street. Yeah. So in the theater district, and it was special. It was really special. And that's where I learned to perform and to just cultivate that kind of getting comfortable on stage in mm-hmm. front of strangers. And then, I got my SAG card doing an episode of Fame on TV with Janet Jackson.
No
I worked
way.
With Janet Jackson, yes.
That's amazing.
I did an episode of a show called Kate and Ally.
And you know what's so funny is I had Adam Shankman on, who obviously directed the movie of mm-hmm. Hairspray based on your movie and based on then the show of your movie. And he choreographed a Janet Jackson video.
No way. And he also choreographed me in a movie called Mrs. Winterbourne with Brendan Fraser.
Wow.
We had a tango scene. And that was in 1995, before I had my son.
Wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, Adam
so
and I go way
how
back.
It's
all very incestuous.
And so did you blind audition for Hairspray?
Yes.
How did you find out about it?
Yes, I was a freshman in college. I was a musical theater major, a miserable musical theater major at Ithaca College. I was not wanting to go back, and it was finals week of my first year, and I heard from someone that said there's a local audition for a movie, a John Waters movie, for the lead role is a fat girl who can dance. And I didn't know who John Waters was. I'd never heard of Divine, but I knew I was a fat girl and I could dance. That I knew. So I drove down. It was like a 5-hour drive in the middle of finals week.
Did you read the script or did they give you sides?
No, I think I had sides. Yeah, I had sides.
Bad shit movie.
Yeah.
On, you know, and but it obviously became what it became. But when you read it, did you go, this is insane?
Who
is this Divine person?
Didn't even think it through. Like, to me, it was a ticket out of going back to college.
Oh,
like,
that's
cool. I was that short sighted. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't even, when I read the script and I processed, I was the star of this movie. I didn't even think that it was going to come out, that it was going to actually, because, you know, I hadn't had a lot of luck. I didn't get cast in one play or musical during my freshman year.
Wow.
And the theater person, the teacher there, professor, told me I wasn't talented, that I wouldn't make it, that I didn't have what it took.
Sometimes that's what you need.
It was her name was Judith Pratt. Well, I remember her.
Sometimes as much as you need your grandmother telling you how great you are, you need someone to tell you can't
do it.
And you're like, oh, really?
Wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
Watch this.
Yeah. No, and I mean, honestly, I wish my whole career has really been like a lot of naivete. I just throw myself into these experiences and these job opportunities, and I don't necessary. I just think I can because they offer it to me.
Good.
You know? And that's how I've sort of rolled with it. Even with our documentaries, it's like I don't see that it's going to have an impact, you know? Like I just do it because it's personal to me and it means something to me.
Right.
And then the fact that it means something to other people is like gravy.
Well, generally, at least if you do it that you are interested in it, you know you have an audience of one.
Exactly.
So describe to me walking in and meeting John Waters.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so I was 18. I was wearing a giant Ithaca College sweatshirt. If you remember the movie, my tits were as big as your head. Okay? I'm not kidding you. They were each as big as your head. So I was, you know, this very large girl. And he, you know, John tells the story of seeing me across the desk, you know, and trying to see if it's really me or was I padding myself. Because
right.
he, in his, you know, vision, he wanted someone massive. And I was large. I was 200 pounds, but I wasn't massive. But so that went well. I mean, it was like we had a banter. I read the sides with him. And that was the end of it. And then it was a couple weeks later, they called me back for one callback. I went. I remember I was sitting in the waiting room with a woman across from me who looked the part perfectly. She looked like little Latya, you know? You know, she had like a bow and a Peter Pan collar, and she was a lot bigger than me. And at one point, I just was making small talk, and I said, oh, you're really pretty. And she said, thank you. And she had like a speech impediment. And I was like, I'm thinking, like my wheels are turning. I'm like, okay, she looks the part, but she can't. This character has to speak. This character, I don't, you know.
And I got this.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was in the bag from that point on. And I had to dance on camera there for the callback. Like they put me on tape, you know, and then I got the part. And again, it was like, phew, I don't have to go back for fall sophomore year. You know, that was it. And oh my God, I'm going to make Scale plus 10. Like, I was so excited. Yeah. It was more money than I'd ever seen. And that was the beginning of the change of the trajectory of my life at that time.
How did you guys meet, Abby?
Oh, how do you think? The Vagina Monologues.
Oh,
how else?
Perfect.
How else?
Perfect.
How do Two Jewish girls meet in New York City.
Yeah.
Performing it or watching it?
I was directing the Vagina Monologues.
Okay.
And so I had directed like hundreds of women in the show because basically after the playwright, after Eve Ensler left performing it as a solo show, we had like three actresses come in every 2 weeks. So Ricky was in one of my casts and, you know, I mean, I work with so many actresses, but there was something about Ricky that just really won me over. She was so real, so authentic. And I remember, do you remember us, our bus ride?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so after the first day of rehearsal, she was like, oh, where do you live? And I was like, I live in Chelsea. And she was like, oh, me too. I live in the West Village. I was like, oh, great. We'll get home together. I start walking to the subway. And she's like, where are you going? I'm like, the train. She's like, oh, no, I take the bus down 9th Avenue. I was like, are you like 80? I've never been on a bus. Like, I've lived in New York my whole life. So I got on like a public bus for the first time with Ricky Lake. And we sat at the way back. And she started telling me some hilarious story. Do you remember this story?
No.
He like made out with some gay friend. It was like one of those typical Ricky, no boundaries.
Yeah. I remember, and I remember who it is. Bruce Bozzi.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we were laughing and laughing. We were like peeing ourselves laughing at the story. And yeah, and that's how
this
really
is in
our friendship
1999.
And do you come?
I think so.
Abby, do you come from a theater background?
I come from a theater background, exactly. So I like directed a lot of theater. I worked on some big shows like Rent.
Tell him.
Rent.
Heard of it.
Heard of it. I did that kind of all over the world.
Who was in the
Vagina
cast
Vagina Monologues. So when I did Rent, well, I did actually the London company I worked on, which had a lot of the original cast members.
Because we made the movie at Revolution Studios.
That's right.
Yeah, from your great play.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I remember the script going around because remember it was with like Spike Lee for a while. Yeah. There was like a whole thing with that, with the Rent movie.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was on that show for years and years, actually.
And then when did you get the bug to start directing film?
I don't even know if I got the bug. So what happened was I think I had been living out in LA and it was sort of the time of Sex and the City. And I had directed like a comedy show in LA with my friends Darlene Hunt and Sean Hayes, and it had gotten really popular and we got it optioned.
In a theater in LA?
Yeah.
Which
like,
one do you remember?
We were doing it at the Groundlings and at the Improv. Like it was sort of a movable feast. You know, it was like a 3-person comedy show.
Mm-hmm. What was it called?
Platonically Incorrect. And Darlene Hunt, who's one of my good friends, a really talented showrunner and writer now, this was like her first piece. So I had done that, and then some people at Warner Brothers were sort of interested in grooming me because they didn't have a lot of female directors, you know? And again, it was like Sex and the City, and there were like all these female-driven comedies, and they wanted more female TV directors. So I started doing this training program, I guess, kind of at Warner Brothers, and I was incredibly bored. Like, just beyond bored, you know? And I was like, this is just
not. I don't know this. I don't know
this.
You don't even know this story?
No. This
oh,
is
God.
Good. You guys are, but this is good. I feel like I'm a therapist.
Amazing.
You guys have known each other a long time. We're going to get to some stuff today.
Yeah.
No, I don't have notes. I just wanted to make sure I get the name of your first documentary right.
He's super. So the, so I think I had like a little bit of, you know, training. And then when I was working on the Vagina Monologues, I was traveling around the world and looking at what was going on with this amazing play. And I had said to the playwright at the time, Eve Ensler, I said, I think this should be a documentary. We've got to capture this. Like, I just sort of can't believe what I'm seeing. The people are doing this in all these languages all over the world with this vagina in 20 languages. So we'd hired a documentary film director to make this documentary about the Vagina Monologues, who ended up dropping out of the project like 10 days before.
So the idea was you were going to record all of the different actresses around the world performing it?
I was actually going to more...
Or do the stories that were inspiring
these
monologues.
It was the stories. It was really about violence against women and how these women were overcoming it with humor. You know, this was like the pre-Me Too, you know, movement, where it was this piece of theater that became a social movement, where women could talk about shame and fear and rape and pleasure. And it was actually starting a social movement called V-Day to end violence against women. So I had this idea, you know, that we would go around and film the real stories of these women behind the play. And then lucky for me, the director quit or pulled out 10 days before. And Eve looked at me and said, well, this was your idea. You direct the documentary. And I was like, ooh, I was on the set at Warner Brothers for like 2 weeks. You know, I was like, I know how to do a reverse angle. Right. You know what I mean? It was just like, I know how to get coverage. I mean, I really knew nothing.
But that was an award-winning documentary.
Yeah, so that documentary premiered at Sundance in 2004. Right. That was my very first film, Until the Violence Stops. Kind of cringy to watch it now. But yeah, it was like trial by fire.
You went all over the world. I mean, I feel like I'm your agent.
You.
Went to Africa, went to incredible places.
Yeah, I went all over the world.
So let's talk about it. This is a great segue to talk about documentaries. Yeah, no, not just about her, about your documentary. So here's the thing. I have been doing this 30 years. I have never made a documentary.
Yeah.
And I've been in the business around people, and I have no idea how the hell to make them. And so, and they're becoming, and I love watching them. I binge. You know, now, especially on Netflix, I can actually watch them more.
Yeah.
Used to just be I would have to wait for my Academy screeners to come because I didn't know where to go see them. Mm. And so, and then I would get them and we would just watch all of them. I love them. And so, but now with Netflix and streamers and things, you can actually watch them. And so I loved yours, Weed the People. And it made me cry 5 times as sobbing at my, you know, in my office. And so, so congrats on that. And we'll talk about that and how to see it in a minute. But I want to talk about, because there's probably a lot of people who are outside of the business that would like to do documentaries and would like to get into the business of documentaries.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about, one, how you guys, there is no business.
Well, there is no business of documentary.
There's no
read my mind.
There's no film business either. I saw your look on your face. It's like, a look. People say, like, are you a theatrical film producer? I go, I am. And they go, oh, I feel bad for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, there's no business. I want to talk about – that being said, mm-hmm. I want to talk about how you got the idea for your first documentary together, The Business of Being Born. And so how you got that idea and then how you actually get the money and make one of these things and then what happens. Like, walk me through the whole process coming up with the idea, raising the money, and making this thing. And then we'll talk about Weed the People. We'll go through that.
Yeah.
Okay?
It's like all torture. Multi-steps of torture, right?
I have done that.
I love the story.
It's difficult.
It was challenging. They're not easy to make, but they're worth it, for sure.
So how did the idea come about?
So, okay. So I was living in the West Village, as she said, doing my talk show. So this is back in – okay, so we worked together in 99. We stayed friends, and I had – 2 children, my first son in a hospital setting, my second at home in my bathtub in the West Village in 2001.
Did you have a doula?
I had a doula. Mm-hmm. I had a midwife. I had an incredible, the most incredible, empowering birth experience that changed everything, and not just becoming a mom.
Okay, so what made you decide to do that?
Okay, here, going back. So I'm a type A Virgo. I plan things to the day, mm-hmm. okay? So this is back in 1996, and a friend of a friend had this amazing birth experience. I went to go meet her newborn baby. You know this, right? It was mm-hmm. Gail Goodman's friend. Mm-hmm. And she's holding this perfectly, incredibly beautiful newborn. She just had the baby a couple days before, and she's sharing her birth story with me of having a natural birth at this birth center in St. Luke's Roosevelt with a midwife. And she's telling me the story, and I'm so intoxicated by her story. And I'm planning to get pregnant. Like, I'm planning, my husband and I, we'd been married 3 years. I was on that show, making a lot of money. I wanted my baby now. So I basically went from that, hearing that positive birth story, to wanting to translate to that, my own experience. And so I had my son. I got pregnant like the month later, and I wanted that natural birth. And what ended up happening for me, I was in that birth center with those midwives, and I didn't progress according to their plan. I didn't, I was just not on their timeline. So mm-hmm. they give you all this intervention. And so after that fact, I was just disappointed. I was happy to have a healthy baby, but I was disappointed that I didn't get to have the experience I wanted. And I felt like I was cheated in some way, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what, you know, the birth bug I got. I was so empowered, even though I didn't have the birth necessarily that I envisioned and felt a little bit was taken away from me. I got hungry for it. I wasn't in college. I didn't find anything I was particularly passionate about studying. Mm-hmm. Musical theater wasn't it. You know, I couldn't find my groove, but this suddenly became my passion. And so I went to this open center conference. It was called The Art of Birthing. And I went to this thing just out of curiosity. I was a new mother. This is back in 97. And I was with mostly midwives and all these birth educators and activists and advocates, and I was seeing Ina Mae Gaskin speak, this pioneer midwife, and I'm seeing this anthropologist speak, and I'm getting every book I can in there, you know, in the lobby, and I just became this like voracious studier of this how why birth normal birth has been taken away from women, and no one seems to give a shit.
Well, I got to say, I've had two children, and we had a third that didn't make it, and so. They're emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. I mean, hospitals are just the whole wing thing, and you know, even though it's dressed up pretty like pink and blue with little flowers and things, it's a f***ing emergency room. Mm-hmm. And so, when my son was born, I was there, and we were weighing him, and like a nurse came in pissed off because somebody had not told her that the baby had died, and she went in the room and embarrassed herself, and I was like. Okay, well, first of all, why say that right now when I'm standing here? And the callousness of it, and I won't even say the hospital, freaked me out. And you start to realize, oh, I'm in just an emergency room. Like, so much shit can go wrong. Yeah. Like, this is not like, you know, what's on the brochure. So, yeah, and then we had a terrible experience at that same hospital and then a better experience at another hospital. But I completely can see that if you want a peaceful, relaxing experience, maybe hospitals are not necessarily the right place for you.
My message is really about informed choice. Like, I don't want to tell people to do what, you know, don't do what I did, but be educated on the choices that you have and what works best for you. So cut to, I had that experience in the hospital. And then I knew the next time if I were to have another child, I wanted to do it differently. And so I had my home birth. I had this incredible water birth in my apartment in 2001, 2 months before 9/11. So I was super empowered and like tapped into my goddess energy in this sacred space. And literally 2 months later, I'm a lactating mother and I watched the plane fly down the Hudson and hit the building.
Wow.
So that just like... It was an epiphany that I had on the roof of my building, and I just said, if I'm going to live, like I felt like I was going to die, and I felt like, oh God, my legacy is my talk show. Like I was like, I was suddenly like, no, if I live through this day, I want to do something a little bit more positive, leave more of an impact, a positive impact. So that's after that I quit. I finished my contract on my show. Mm-hmm. I would have been sued if I quit, but I had another year and a half on my show. I finished my contract. I left my marriage and I left New York.
Wow.
And I started anew out here. And I really kind of soul searched on where I thought I could make a difference. Where am I needed? You know, and I looked at cancer and AIDS and this and that. But I felt like I was so profoundly changed by my birth experience with the midwife that I reached out to Abby. We were friends. We stayed in touch, you know, through me moving out to LA. And I was like, look, I have this idea. I don't know what it is. I didn't know it was a documentary at that time. And I gave her my 9-hour birth footage. I gave her Ina Mae Gaskin's book, Spiritual Midwifery, and this anthropologist, Robbie Davis Floyd, birth as an American rite of passage. And I was like, here. And she took all that, and a week later, she's like, I think it's a documentary.
Oh, that's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you always pick stuff that's just really, really important to you, or did you feel like this story needs to be told? Like, how do you approach it as a filmmaker?
You know what's so weird? I was thinking about this yesterday. I feel like almost when we're making a film, there's like almost like a defensive reflex that kicks up in me. That I just feel like this is so boring and no one's going to care about this. Mm-hmm. Honestly.
So do I, by the way, when I'm making films.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Everybody does.
Everybody does?
I think
like
so.
Part of the process? Okay.
I think you go into – here's how it is for me. I think when I start a movie, I am pretty confident that it'll entertain people.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the drudgery of doing it,
yes.
You start to really – you
yes.
have to really have that North Star.
Yes.
Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
if you don't, you can really lose sight in the day-to-day of the drudgery of making a movie.
Yes.
It's hard. And
yes.
to get up every day and go, okay, here we go again.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, in scripted, you know, features, that you know, the 70th take can just be a death. You know,
yeah.
And I don't mean somebody doing 70 takes in a row. I mean, by the time you've gone through all the coverage and the master and the overs and things, you get so
sucked dry
uh-huh. of hearing this line over and over again. So I completely
yeah.
understand that.
Yeah.
And so talk me through. Now you've come up with the idea.
Yeah.
You've now said I've watched 90 hours of birth.
Nine
hours of birth.
It was
probably,
enough.
Probably 90.
I'm a guy. I heard 90. And so, walk me through now. Mm-hmm. What happens? How do you guys go about mounting this thing?
Yeah, I mean, that was really challenging. I think in the beginning, you know, when we were making The Business of Being Born, and I was like, okay, like, there's something here. You know, there's something to be told. And I was so on the other side of it. I was very skeptical. A, I had never been pregnant, didn't have any children, and was 100% sure that I would be getting an epidural or whatever I could, like, the second I stepped foot in the hospital.
Right.
You know, so I was coming from a very, like, healthy skepticism about this whole home birthy thing. And when I knew Ricky and she was going through that home birth experience, I really was kind of like not sure what to make of it. You know, it was like when your friend does something, you're like, oh, yeah, that's wow, amazing. You know, and in the back of your head, you're thinking, why in the world would she ever want to do that?
How big is your bathtub? What
is
happening?
It was not a big bathtub.
Standard.
You could see it in the movie. You could see it in the movie.
And I was extra large.
Oh, you were not. You were gorgeous. And I mean, it was amazing to watch her do it. But I'm saying, like, you know, I really, you know, but I felt like a nugget. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You just feel this little sparkle of like, wow, I didn't really know about any of this. And for me, I had always been so involved in kind of feminist causes and women's empowerment. And I'd never connected giving birth to women's empowerment.
Oh, wow.
I never understood how birth was supposed to be an empowering rite of passage to sort of transition a woman into motherhood.
As opposed to just getting through it and coming home and, and start taking care of the
baby. I thought it was like a medical event, like plastic surgery.
Right.
And
by the way, you're not wrong.
I'm not wrong,
right? That's the way most hospitals approach it.
I agree. And so then I think we decided, well, we've got Ricky Lake. We'll just go get some funding, which turned into a year
a big goose egg
of meetings.
Nobody wanted – everyone loved the idea. They were all very intrigued, but they said, come back with the finished film. Everyone.
Or they would like – you know, there'd be a room of women execs that would be like, this is fantastic. And they'd all tell their birth stories and they'd be like, yes, we have to tell this. But like we couldn't get a deal. Then
so who do you
we
approach?
Did get a deal.
Okay, so hold on. Who do you reach out to? Like, what's in
Lifetime.
Your mind? You go, I'm going
to
reach out to
CNN,
a distribution first, correct?
We went to networks, right? So we went to, like, I think we had a meeting at Lifetime. We had a meeting at the Oprah's
Or Discovery.
We had a Discovery we did finally. So then we ultimately did get some interest from Lionsgate, who then hooked us up with a production company who then did get us a deal with Discovery Health.
And that was – so that was the idea when you guys first decided you were going to make a documentary was to put it on television, given you have a huge
Because Discovery Health had done that documentary about the guy who was eaten by the bear.
Grizzly Man.
Bingo.
Yeah.
They had done Grizzly Man. So we wanted the Grizzly Man model. We wanted a documentary with Discovery Health that premiered at a prestigious film festival and then like ended up on TV later.
Got it.
But anyway, everything fell apart with Discovery Health in a pretty hilarious way.
And you right now,
I don't remember it being hilarious. But,
So right now, all you have is 9 hours of her birth footage.
No. We had shot.
We had a trailer.
Yeah,
not a lot.
We bought the
couple
equipment.
Days.
Yeah, we
had cut the trailer. The production company paid for a trailer.
Okay.
You know that Discovery Health.
And what were you shooting
pitched.
On?
I mean, tape. We're talking, this is 2004,
I mean, were you shooting on like a broadcast quality camera and just video? And
what kind of camera was it?
We had bought a Panasonic
But it was like commercial grade. It wasn't like network grade. You were like out there with a commercial grade camera, but not a whole crew with lights and cameras.
No.
And you had already had this documentary under your belt about the vagina monologue. So you have a pretty good pedigree.
I'd already had the B-Day one, had a little bit of a pedigree. So
and then you cut a sizzle.
We cut a sizzle, and that sizzle was more hard-hitting than the movie ended up really kind of being, but it was a good sizzle. I don't know if you remember
I don't remember.
It was like birth. It was we used the Mel Brooks footage. The Not Mel Brooks.
It was Monty Python footage.
I have Alzheimer's.
Although
this
I can call Mel Brooks a friend of mine.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh my god.
It was
amazing.
We used a lot of existing footage, some funny Monty Python stuff. We put a sizzle together.
So you were coming at it from a place of not like hard hitting, like this is going to be depressing, but like lighthearted and uplifting and have a little bit of
comedy. No, the production company really wanted like a Michael Moore style. Like I remember when we were doing tape, they like, we want Courier font. Courier font.
Right.
Going on, you know, like birth in America is a medical emergency. You know, like they wanted it to be sort of, you know, hard hitting.
Mm-hmm.
So we got this deal with Discovery Health, and they actually gave us quite a big deal. I think it was like $1 million, and we are going to do a 6-part series called Manhattan Midwives.
Oh, wow.
About home birth midwives in Manhattan, and then a one-off, you know, the 90-minute that would be the feature doc.
Right.
So we're like, oh, great. So we like get some money. We're shooting. I'm like now shooting so many characters because I'm like, oh, my God, it's not just a documentary anymore, right? I got to fill a three-part series, I think it was. Sorry.
And how do you
so
cast the midwives?
I'm shooting all these people.
How do you cast them?
Well, we got the best midwife. I mean, there aren't that many home birth midwives in New York City.
That's surprising.
And no, there were like a handful working at the time. And Ricky's midwife was like,
she was like, absolutely not.
In
she
Africa
not be,
at the
she,
time.
And she would not be on camera.
She was not that type.
No.
But she introduced us to like her partner, you know, and I met her for coffee. She lived right near me in the East Village. Met her for coffee and I was like, boom. Boom, boom. Like, this is the character.
Yeah, the character.
She's articulate. She's passionate. She's quirky. She's a single mom waking up, delivering babies in the middle of the night. She's, you know, she was amazing. I was like, this is her.
And then did she turn you on to the five others or however many you needed?
Well, we didn't have – no. Then she – you know, then we ended up meeting some patients,
okay,
some clients through her. So that was like starting to find the women that we followed. Then well, we kind of wanted to cover demographics, so we found another midwife who worked in a totally different, more African-American community in Flatbush. And she didn't do home births. She did more hospital births. So we had her.
But she brought in the whole insurance situation with having
she brought
a natural birth,
out of
hospital
things.
Birth. Yeah.
But anyway, so this is all leading up to when I went down to meet with the Discovery Health executives at some place they call the Death Star, which is somewhere outside
in
of
Pennsylvania.
Baltimore.
Yeah, it's down there. Yes.
They take a train down there. I've got my sizzle. I've got my stuff I shot. I'm in a room with all these execs. I play the footage. I mean, everybody's face goes white. And this woman, I'll never forget it, she turns to me and she said, you know that like all our sponsors are drug companies. And she looked at me and she literally said, you understand that we cannot indict the medical industrial complex in any way.
Wow.
And I said, oh, that's like our film. So I think, whoa. It was just like this moment where we all looked in the room and we're like, this is not going to go forward. So, of course, then they had like a budget problem and
they
dropped the project.
Wow.
But we'd already gotten like $50,000 from them, which was great, you know, so we got to keep that. And then we were on our own.
Are you looking for a new car? Do you know how to navigate what you're looking for? MSRP, invoice, list price, dealer price. It's enough to confuse anybody. You just want a price that means something. Introducing True Price from True Car. They compete for your business by showing you what other people pay for the car that you're after. Now you'll know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, all from the comfort of home. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
The King of Celebrity Gossip is now on Podcast One.
Kim Kardashian, I think she's nice, but obnoxious and annoying.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast with Chris Booker each week to get your fill on the latest news in show business and beyond. And nothing is off the table.
I think he should take her last name when they get married. He's already her bitch. He should just be her bitch officially.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is the Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
This is a great segue because you don't stop taking on the pharmaceutical industry because now your next documentary is doing the exact same thing. So now
wait for our next one. We have a whole nother one about birth control.
I want to hear about it. Okay, so now walk me through now. I think I know how you came up with the weed.
Yeah, I told you.
Yeah.
I told you.
So walk me through the coming up with that idea for that documentary and finding the funding for that. Take me through the exact same process for now. Because now you've had two successful documentaries under your belt. Mm-hmm. You still have Ricky Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've proven yourselves. Mm-hmm. So now walk me through coming up with the idea for, you know, Weed the People and how that gets funded.
Yeah.
Well, that started. So basically, you know, we were both green in putting out The Business of Being Born, like just seeing the impact that it was going to have and all of that. So cut to in about 2012, my husband, Christian Evans, who sadly is not with us any longer. He passed away last year. But he was researching cannabis for his own healing, his own physical chronic pain and mental stuff. I mean, he was just constantly bedbound and on the computer finding CBD and, you know, all these things and trying to come up with a cocktail that works for him. At the same time, I had done Dancing with the Stars, and a little fan, the mom, had found me on Twitter, and she was going through chemotherapy, and she would watch my videos, my dance videos with Derek Hough. She loved Derek Hough. She would watch it when she was getting her chemo. And so I just befriended them via social media. Next thing you know,
and she had cancer?
She had something called neurofibromatosis 1, which is not actually cancer, but it causes tumors to grow on your nerve ending. So they treat it as cancer. So she had an optic glioma in her brain. And so she was very sick. She was 6 years old, 20-something pounds. She was this little – she had no hair and glasses, and something about this child – moved me to the point where Christian and I moved her and her family into our home for 6 weeks.
Wow.
And they lived in an illegal state. They lived in Illinois. And we moved them to California and took them on this journey to find integrative medicine, including cannabis.
Had they been using CBD oil or anything?
No,
THC?
They were completely...
So she was just a fan. And because of your husband, you know, exploring this for pain, you thought this might...
It wasn't even that. It was like, this girl needs help. I can't explain it.
You
because
explored many things, though.
We did
her.
Reiki. We did osteopath.
We took her to specialists.
We took her to all these different specialists. I mean, it was real. We surprised her at Disneyland with all the princesses.
Right.
Like, she thought she was going to another doctor appointment, and then the princesses jump out.
Right.
And, I mean, we fell in love with this child for some reason I can't explain.
Oh, she was.
It was like a divine intervention. She was just very special to me and to my husband. And so I'm telling Abby, literally, is my friend. She's in New York. I live here. I'm like, dude, you're not gonna believe what the new chapter in my life is. Like, this family's, she's like, who's living with you? Like, this girl, and I'm chartered a jet. We're flying her to Mendocino to meet this cannabis doctor. She's like, I think this is our next movie.
Right.
Like, she's the visionary that can see the big picture. I just have the life experience.
You didn't even know what it was. You just thought, oh my gosh, there's this girl who needs help. She's in pain, and we're gonna try to use cannabis to alleviate her pain and maybe shrink the tumors, which is a byproduct. Did you know about this going in, you guys, or was it just
in the case of Ricky Lake, I'm
living for today and I'm going to stop this pain today.
Well, Dr. Courtney Christian, who was doing this research online, found a HuffPo Live thing happen on is that CNN? Huffington Post Live. And it was Dr. Courtney, who was based out of Mendocino, and he was telling the story of an 8-month-old little baby that they'd basically eradicated the brain tumor by giving cannabis oil in the baby's pacifier. And they showed the images, the MRI scans. And so that's where we got the idea to reach out to him. And we cold called him. Like, I remember Christian and I in bed calling him directly.
Now, that you also chronicle a baby that exact thing happens to. Was that the same baby or
No, that baby was.
I think also it was like I was hearing about this and kind of these pieces. Like, I knew about this little girl. She had the new Ricky Lake show at the time. So this girl was even on the new Ricky Lake show because you did a whole segment.
We did a whole thing on
medical marijuana and cannabis.
Okay.
So she was like on the new Ricky Lake show. I knew what was going on, and I was reading the research that they were sending me about CBD and cannabis oil, and, like, you know, it was like, maybe, you know, this could help stabilize her tumors, and maybe this could counteract the chemo, because they had, like, been to so many specialists with this little girl, and nobody had anything to offer her. So, yeah, I mean, I just kept hearing all the pieces coming together from, like, across the country until it was like, okay, we're doing this. We found, you know, we're going to try the cannabis. It was like this, and I can, you know, I can tell, like, with Ricky, it's like, I think that Ricky is, for some reason, you know, her intuition, like, she always seems to be, like, a few light years ahead of the rest of the world. Like, she picks up on things, you know, like, even, like, nobody knew what a doula was when we were shooting The Business Being Born. Literally nobody, you know? She was sort of ahead of the curve. So I could just hear there was this excitement, there was this passion, you know, and I was like, wow, this is wow, you know? I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm reading all these studies, and, like, I think this might be a film.
Did you just grab your camera and head out there? Like,
yeah,
do you remember what this camera was?
I do, because it was way too much camera. It was like an F3. It was because, you remember, my brother also shoots all the behind the scenes for studio films.
Okay.
So my brother had his crew, and they were going on location because somehow they were on the plane with us, and we had his crew.
Wow.
And he works with, like, Judd Apatow.
Yeah, at the time. And so it was like,
what's your brother's name?
We got Andrew Epstein.
Okay.
And so, he does all, yeah, he does amazing work and does all the EPK. So it was his crew, I remember. Mm-hmm. And because we had way too much gear for what we were shooting. It was like, so we were so way over geared.
But you didn't care about anything. You're like, we're going to start this. Mm-hmm. I'm getting this footage.
I put up the first 60,000.
She put up the first year, yeah, of funding. Ricky, like, put it in, and we just started.
And do you then go, okay, we have a movie here. We're going to go back to Discovery. We're going to go back to these. Obviously not Discovery, because you take on the pharmaceutical companies again. Did you go to traditional way of trying to get it financed, or did you guys just bootstrap it?
Didn't we go to CNN on this one?
We did do. I mean, it's interesting because we have another film that's coming out right on the heels of this. So was it, which one was first?
I can't remember because this one is on birth control. It's called Sweetening the Pill.
I think that Sweetening the Pill came along almost at the same time.
So we were pitching kind of both of them.
We were kind of pitching both because I remember meeting at Netflix and we had Sweetening the Pill and Weed the People like on the table, and they wanted Weed the People, and we were like, oh, no, that one's already done. Like, it's this one, you know. But
what did you have when you were showing? You were showing Sizzles again?
Sizzles, okay. Yeah. So we had like a 10-minute sizzle for each one. And so for...
On Weed the People, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is that dorky stuff I like to get into. On your sizzle and Weed the People,
yeah.
Had you already found the subjects that are in the movie, or was it again?
Yes,
like,
but we lost the subject. That was the other thing that happened.
The little girl that I took to Mendocino,
she was our first subject.
She's not in the film.
And then they decided they weren't comfortable being in a documentary, so we were almost like, oh, maybe there's no film, you know, because she had been like the heartbeat of the film, and we had been filming, I mean, not just her, we'd been filming doctors and experts and conferences and meeting other patients, but there was like a moment where you're like, oh, like maybe this is over, you know? And then just, I think as fate would have it, like out of nowhere, we got baby Sophie in the film. Like she kind of fell into our laps.
And she found us via Facebook, a Facebook group. And she had been a fan of the Business of Being Born.
Mother,
so it's like there's a trust factor and a credibility.
The mom had been a fan of the movie. And it was a doula on Facebook said, oh, this mom is... you know, looking for some holistic support for her baby going through chemo. And I mentioned that you and Ricky were doing this new film. So it was kind of this crazy way that we ended up like almost rebooting.
And she was the one with the ocular.
Yeah, the optic pathway glioma.
Firefighter father?
No, that's the optic glioma, the little blonde girl. Sophie. Yeah, she was there.
And they shot a lot of that footage with them on a GoPro.
I was going to say, because there's a moment where she finds out that the CBD is not working as well as they wanted to, and she has to do chemo. And she is, it's heart wrenching.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a heart wrenching moment.
Yeah.
And I was like, that she's filming this herself because she's in the back seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Aiming at her husband.
Yeah.
Sobbing hysterically.
Yeah, she did a lot of dosing.
We had to give them a GoPro because first of all, we couldn't get access to these hospitals ever.
Right.
It was impossible. And it was just frankly, I mean, part of it because I lived in New York. I mean, I have people on call in LA to help me produce. But I just couldn't, you know, you couldn't always be there with them.
So walk me through the making of that. So you're giving all your subjects GoPros.
Not all of them. No, not all.
Really?
Just Tracy, right? Who else had a GoPro? Cecilia?
And the rest you're just following around. Like you're following around all the other subjects. You're following around the doctors. You're doing stand-ups. You're going to the conventions.
Yep.
And you're one crew. And how much are you there? And how does it work? It's filming a documentary. And how long did it take?
The bulk of it.
2014 to now, right?
2012 is when we started with the first little girl.
Well, that was the first pre-production year.
But 2013 is the first footage that we actually show.
Because the stuff at the end is remarkable. It's 4 years later. So walk me through the production of a documentary of this size.
Yeah. Well, I think also you don't really know. I don't know. In the beginning, I'm not sure if we knew it was going to be like this 4 to 5 year process. And also, of course, you know, it was so risky because we're following these children. And honestly, we don't really know, like, who's going to survive even and who's not and who's going to do well and who's, you know, it's sort of hard to figure out what the arc is. But I think from the beginning, we knew that we didn't, you know, that there was a lot of content about medical cannabis, like on Vice and on CNN. There's, you know, more short form journalistic. And we wanted to really get in there and do the human story and do the long the long rides. And sometimes because it takes so long to put all the funding together, you know, and you have these phases of like having a little bit of financing and then, oh, we got an investor, you know, a financer on board.
We but did then an Indiegogo.
We had to do an Indiegogo.
And, oh, okay.
Yeah. So it takes.
So who ultimately did you get to finance this endeavor?
Let me also say, can I just interrupt? I'm sorry. Yeah. I want you to know, I financed the business of being born myself.
And what was ultimately the budget of that?
$450,000?
Something like that.
Yeah, $450,000.
And then how does someone get their money back at that point?
We didn't break even on the movie.
Okay.
We should have made a fortune on the movie, but the problem is that we sold it to New Line and Netflix. Well, Netflix had Red Envelope at the time, which was their theatrical. So we sold it right out of Tribeca, and then we didn't see a dime from Warner Brothers for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was the problem, was that like
it was pre
it was pre iTunes, pre self distributed. I mean, we should have done amazing on the business of being born. It was just the business model when we sold it was not ready.
Which is what we were talking about with Netflix and all these new streamers things. So who then financed We the People?
So ultimately, like Ricky was saying, she had put in like an initial $60,000, and then we ended up getting connected through a mutual friend with a company called Mangu TV, Mangusta Productions. They had done Giancarlo Canavesio and Soul Tryon, and they had done a bunch of films that were sort of more centered around like plant medicine. They'd done Neurons to Nirvana, Lottery of Birth, and this was, you know, somebody said this is really like up their alley. So they came in with $175,000, and then we raised like $150,000 on Indiegogo.
So it's around the same amount of money. You guys are in that $400,000,
$450,000.
And then we raised some more money with our amazing executive producer, James Costa, who came on at the end to really help us with the theatrical, because then you have to finance the theatrical distribution as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it feels a little never ending.
So you get through the shooting of it, which takes 4 years.
Mm-hmm. It took 5.5.
Besides the two that you lost.
The baby that we first swallowed, Sophie, is 9 months old, and she's in the end of the movie, she's 5.5.
So 5.5 years you're doing this. You get all the financing. You're editing as you go, I'm assuming, or are you waiting to see how the stories evolve before you start to get into that post process? How does the post production process go in a documentary?
This one was different for me. The We the People was different for me. We ended up working with one editor over the course of many months, who really edited like some amazing scenes and helped like create the themes of the movie. Mm-hmm. But then actually I brought on another editor who came on for like 2 weeks, and she did the structure.
Oh, wow.
And then I brought on another editor, our final editor, because then, you know, that one wasn't available. She wasn't available when we needed her. Brought on a third editor who really brought the movie home, Kristen Nutile. She, you know, did the last couple months on the film and really brought the movie home. But that was really different for me, because I'm used to, you know, and now, like, and we're in production on Sweetening the Pill, you know, I've got this one editor. She'll sit down for 16 weeks.
She's doing it now. She's editing.
You're editing on Avid, or you're editing on Final Cut Pro? What are you editing on?
We're editing on Premiere.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so once you then get it done, mixed everything, it's on a digital hard drive somewhere. What's the plan to get this thing shown to distributors that you can actually start to maybe get some of your money back?
Oh, so We the People, we sold it in South By.
So that's what you do. So the idea is, with a documentary, you want to go to a festival rather than like just sending the link to various distributors. You want to get that the communal feeling of having people see it with an audience, so that they can be moved. By the way, I'm sure there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, but no, I think you want to get a sales rep. And so, you know, we use Submarine our sales rep. Yeah, for both films. So I think the sales rep can be really helpful, because sometimes they – it, you know, could show it to a potential buyer who might just premiere it at a festival.
Right.
That didn't happen with us, but some of the films that were in competition with us at South By were already purchased, although they didn't really announce that. You know what I mean? And then they use the festival for like press to debut the film, but they're actually already have deals.
So when did James come on board, Costa?
James Costa recently, just a couple.
James Costa.
Okay, so
came
you guys knew your sales
after
rep.
We sold.
Got it.
And after we got the offer from Netflix,
he came about from Summit. literally right. from Summit, Summit when I Summit. Met you in yeah. February,
oh, right.
which was the 1 year anniversary of my husband's death. And I met yeah. Keegan Peterson and, mm-hmm. oh gosh, Cash Rick Kimball. Rick right. Kimball. And those guys are entrepreneurs in the cannabis yeah. space. And they, I mean, literally, they begged me to screen the movie for them.
Just, I remember you screened it.
It was
there.
Just the, yeah. we screened it for the big, the, all of Summit, but we did it for just the four of them okay. first. And they were like, what do you need? And like, we don't have the money to cut a trailer. And they all pitched in oh, for the $10,000 to cut the trailer.
Well, let's back up for 1 second.
Yeah. yeah.
So you guys knew this sales rep. Mm-hmm. You have your $450,000-ish invested.
That's right.
You hire a sales rep, and the
yes.
sales rep says, you know, we're going to take it to all the distributors that we feel are appropriate for this format. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming it was Netflix and mm-hmm. Amazon and all mm-hmm. those. And they then say, on this movie, we feel let's wait till South By, which mm-hmm. is a perfect mm-hmm. audience for this.
Yeah.
Right? And so we'll generate the, some heat, and then we'll sell it. Is that the way it
That's
happened?
That's the way they decided to sell it. I will tell you that, you know, we were deciding between South By and Tribeca. And our sales reps were worried about South By because they said the buyers weren't showing up to the festival anymore. Yeah. They were having a problem getting tickets with the way the festival was run. Festival's like it's a very egalitarian festival.
Yeah.
They really, you know, promote it as like a local festival.
It's also heavily leaning into tech there.
That's what I was
heavy.
Just going to say. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they were nervous about it, and we weren't sure whether to wait for Tribeca because, of course, like when we premiered Business Being Born in Tribeca, I mean, it was just – we had such a huge amount of press
yeah.
because you're in New York
mm-hmm.
City. When you're in Austin, you know, it was like you don't really make
right.
a splash, you know. So that was kind of – and it's actually quite disappointing because at the end of the day, and I think our sales reps would say the same thing, you have these amazing screenings at South By and none of these buyers show up. They all watch the movie on a link.
Right.
So it's almost like –
you just showed it for an audience and didn't really
yeah,
have the experience.
Yeah, it's almost like you could have just mailed the link to all these people anyway. And there's not that many buyers for documentaries now. I mean, with Amazon out of the market, it's tough. You know,
yeah.
it's like Netflix. Like there's Netflix, there's Hulu. I mean, there's
right.
not. There's
Netflix
HBO.
Are the best.
Yeah.
So how did your film sell then?
Yeah. So we, I think, were really, you know, fortunate that they were able to, like, you know, share a link with Netflix. And they loved the film, and you know, they were extremely moved by it and made us a really, really good offer out of South By. But you know, I think we were really lucky, and I feel for a lot of the films, you know, and our sales rep said they had a ton of films there
mm-hmm.
that had great buzz, great reviews, and nothing,
right.
you know, and
but
I.
That's what happened at Tribeca too with The Business Being Born. We sold out of that festival, and
yeah.
a lot of movies didn't during that time.
Yeah, I don't know about this model, to tell you the truth. I don't know that it's a really sustainable model, and I think the sales reps are really frustrated with it. And
what do you mean by the model being
the
not
model,
sustainable? Do you mean just making a movie and selling it to Netflix?
No, I mean the whole idea of like putting all these years and all this time and all this money into making something and then like pinning all your hopes on like this one festival, and then you have this like handful of screenings and you have to like jockey for, you know, the right people to come
right,
see
the time
movie.
Slot, the right
and
everything.
Then like, yeah. you know, how many films ever get like a bidding war? Not,
right.
right? I mean, it's mostly like you're kind of at their mercy. Like, you don't have much to negotiate back with, you know,
right.
and you know, I think that it ends up and Netflix is, you know, they're an amazing platform in terms of sharing your film, but like they don't do any marketing,
right.
you know, so then it's sort of incumbent upon you after you sell the film, then we had to go raise another $100,000 to release it theatrically.
Right.
You know, so it's sort of
that
like,
was important to you.
Beyond absolutely.
Just leaving
well,
it, absolutely.
Get national press.
Yes.
You know, that's
right.
the only way. You won't get any sort of press. Even
this
with
issue.
Having someone like me attached to it,
right.
you don't. You have to do a real theatrical. And we wanted to do a qualifying, Oscar qualifying run.
I understand.
Yeah.
And so, yeah,
so that's,
you have
that's,
to
then
invest.
You have to raise the money
but it,
to do
it,
that.
It just feels like you're running a charity. It really does.
Right.
You know, and it's like a kind of endless raising. So I don't, you know.
But we love it.
Huh?
But
no,
we
but
love it.
We
no,
love,
but it's an important thing to talk about
love,
because, yes, of course, what you're doing is important and it's amazing and
yeah.
people should definitely see it and they
yeah.
will. But it's a business. And so you
yeah.
if it, you know, that's the thing I want to talk about
yeah.
is I want to talk about the business because I don't understand it. And now
mm-hmm.
I'm understanding why I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's people need to go in with their eyes wide open. Yes, you obviously, Ricky, you've had huge success in your life, and this is important to you, and it's worth doing. But for people that are just, you know, have to pay the bills and live their life, I want people to know going in, like, what to expect.
Yeah, and I mean,
because I think people, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no.
I think people do have this idea that I'll make it, and Netflix will buy it for a shit ton of money, and I'll, you know, it'll be great. And there's a ton of competition.
No, it's first of all, it's like a child. It's like a child. You will always be taking care of that child.
Right.
Your film is never like in the hands of somebody you trust. Maybe a babysitter for a few hours, but that's your child.
That's a good analogy.
Good analogy. Absolutely.
That's your child. You know.
Absolutely.
And like we're still trying to get the business of Bourne back from Warner Brothers after 10 years. You know, we're trying to get the rights back because there's so much we want to do with the film. You know,
and what is the issue?
So, I don't know if there's an issue. We just asked for it back.
Okay.
You know, we just were trying to see maybe they'll.
Well, it wasn't on any of the platforms.
Right.
I mean, this film is like evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's getting pregnant. It's the go-to film. It's it's as pertinent today as it was 10 years ago.
Sure. I have a good friend named Lori Bregman who's a doula.
Oh, Lori.
Yeah, we know Lori.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. But it's like the film. And so we want people to have access to it. And it wasn't even on iTunes up until like a month ago.
Netflix. It was off Netflix.
Wow.
People were emailing us. Like people were coming up to Ricky at Burning Man going, I can't find your film. No one can find your film, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And
that's
so it's
amazing.
Infuriating. But the problem is we sold it to New Line Red Envelope and then that folded into Warner Brothers. So they don't understand that the title
that
they have.
I think they don't. It's like, look, I mean, self-distribution is like a huge job. But I do think you're right. Like people can't have this fantasy that you're going to like make this brilliant thing and you're going to sell it for $1 million and then it doesn't work that way.
Right.
It's like you're really involved. And I'll tell you like – you know, the distribution for Weed the People has been exhausting. And like, you know, we were so upset last week in New York. We found out the New York Times passed on reviewing the film. And we're like, wait a minute.
Why?
Are you kidding me? Like they just had the cover of the style section was CBD.
Why would they pass on reviewing
it? They won't tell us. They were passed.
Wow.
So there's disappointing things where you're like, wait, we just invested $100,000, you know what I mean, in this release to get a review in the New York Times so that people would know about this issue and this movie. And they said no and we're powerless. You know what I mean? So it's
– I have to say I've had a lot of movies I wish the New York Times wouldn't review.
That's funny.
So, okay. So where do you sit – so where does the movie sit right now? You have weedthepeoplemovie.com.
Yes.
You had a premiere last night.
In LA.
Where do you sit in the distribution channel now?
Yeah. We're in a great place in the distribution channel. So we've opened in New York. We open in LA on Friday, November 2nd.
And they purchase tickets from that website?
At the Lemley NoHo. Yeah. Well, if you go on weedthepeoplemovie.com, you just click on the screenings tab and every movie theater that it's playing shows up.
So explain to me why you created that website.
Because we have so many different ways to see the film.
Right.
Like, and that's the thing, like I honestly think now you need like a PhD in distribution. It is so complicated.
Right.
There's the digital deal, the theatrical deal, the VOD deal, the SVOD, the TVOD, the IVOD. There's like so many like anagrams. I don't even know what the things stand for.
And
it's
do you
very
own all of those different distribution channels that you can sell piecemeal, or does Netflix come
piecemeal.
In and go, we own everything?
Netflix takes SVOD.
Okay, great.
Okay, so Netflix takes SVOD for a certain number of years. You know, they license it, which is so different, right? Because Business of Being Born, they took it forever.
Right.
15 years, sorry. 15 years. I mean, that's kind of forever.
That's forever for us.
And then, you know, but this now it's only a couple years. You know what
great.
I mean? It's such a better deal.
And
the deals are better.
It's coming on Netflix at 4/20 of next year.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
That's
and
cool.
So you guys now own all the other VODs and you're selling them piecemeal or is it all through this website?
So, no. So nothing's really going through the website. Basically, we are doing our theatrical rollout. We will be releasing this film theatrically. I think we are going to have theatrical bookings through February.
And are you booking them yourself? Who's now?
No, we have a theatrical distributor called Abramarama, and the chapter that's this part of Abramarama that's releasing is called Mangurama.
Okay.
This is their consciousness label.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And they
so
invest Mangurama, in your film, so they have a vested interest in getting your
They're not invested in it. They're,
oh, wow.
They're you know, we had to raise the budget, which includes a service fee for them to distribute it. So, but yes, they're vested in the profits. So, of course, you know, they want to see it do well. Yeah.
So this is, you had to do this all yourselves. Find all of these
beyond.
Different people
it's beyond.
To help
And
you.
Just so you know, like I literally just got an email on the way here from our digital distributor saying, hi guys, like I got to pitch cable like tomorrow.
Wow.
We need everything signed, sealed, delivered. We're like, ah, you know, there's so many deals. And then we have Tug that's doing our EDU.
What is
EDU? And our non-theatrical and our theatrical on-demand.
Okay. Man.
And then we have another platform called OV that's doing digital screenings. You can host like private digital screenings. I mean, there's so many
educational
platforms.
Version.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
So you end up, it's like a full-time job because you're working with so many different outlets.
Is there any company that just handles all of distribution for something like this? Like could you call, you know, Frank over at We Take Care of It, the company that just says we're going to handle all the distribution for you, or is it this is the way it is right now in documentaries? You have to just bootstrap it yourself and make it happen.
To make it easier, but it's more expensive, right?
Yeah, I think there's ways. Like, I mean, one of the offers, you know, we had gotten for digital could have been really appealing to a different kind of filmmaker, right? It was like somebody who was going to come along and say, hey, I'm going to absorb the Netflix deal. I'm going to give you an extra chunk of money on top of that. And I'm going to like, we're going to pay it all out now. So you get all your money now. Right. You know what I mean? Because Netflix pays out quarterly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we own the film for 15 years.
Right.
So we would never make that deal again, Ricky and I, ever.
Right.
Because we know what happened when we did that. But like for a certain kind of filmmaker that just wants the money now and wants to kind of move on and do their next thing, that could work. But no, I mean, I think in terms of all the rights, no. I mean, you could definitely find the same distributor to do like theatrical and digital.
Mm-hmm.
But then they would have to find, you know, probably an educational and non-theatrical partner.
Right. And you have Ricky who can go around and do talk shows and, mm-hmm. and get it out there, which most people might not have.
Yeah. No, that's been huge for us. Yeah.
So I asked this of all my guests. So now Ricky doesn't count because she had a grandmother that told her she was great and she was never going to lose. If you were looking back at somebody who wants to be a documentary filmmaker, And what's your advice to pursue that career, both of you?
I mean, I wish I knew. I mean, I really am so grateful I had my talk show because that's what enabled us to get The Business Being Born made. But it's just follow your passion. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but like really, I was driven to do something with my passion, you know, and I had the means and I had the fortuitous nature to choose my dear friend who's brilliant. I mean, she's brilliant. You're brilliant. And we're such
Once
a good
again,
team.
I feel blessed to be a part of this therapy session.
No, it's really, I mean, it's incredible. It's divine. You know, I really am so grateful that we have collaborated in this way and we both have such our strengths. We just work so well together as a team and we're doing it from the heart. Like this is really about changing the world in a positive way.
You have to. Because there's
it's not about getting
business
rich.
Is really, well, yeah, mm-hmm. but I'm doing the podcast mm-hmm. for the same reason. So
yeah.
Walk me through practically how you become a documentary filmmaker in this day and age.
You know, I'm the worst person to ask because, I mean, I went to theater school. You know, I mean, I have theater training. And honestly, I really fell into this in so many ways and learned on the go. And there's probably so much that I still don't really know, you know, because I've never really, like, formally studied filmmaking. And I feel but for me, it's really just, you know, I think if you have a sense of story, for me, it's like I feel like my skill set is the same if I'm writing, if I'm directing theater, if I'm directing a documentary film, if I were to direct a narrative film. You know, it's really having a sense of structure and story and arc and casting. Right. And all of those instincts. But I would say, you know, documentary is particularly challenging because the subjects, the relationship with the subjects is deep and requires a lot of trust and care, you know. And it's not like hiring an actor that like, if they're an asshole, it's like whatever, they'll be gone or you can fire them or you can get another, you know what I mean? It's not like they're not getting paid.
Right.
They're trusting you to tell their story of their life and you kind of ride this line where you know you don't want to feel like you're exploitative in any way, right? But you need to like cover a certain amount of things and so I think that, you know, you have to be sort of like part therapist and like part coach and part, you know, because you really it's you know, for the kind of documentaries that we make, you know what I mean? I think, you know, I mean, We're not doing these, you know, Ken Burns pieces where it's all like archival footage and historic. We're not doing, you know, we're doing mostly pretty like raw, provocative material. But I really truly think like that if you're you understand, I think they're all these films in some ways end up being about the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like when we're up there, you know, at the end of the screening, like last night for We the People, or we're up there for The Business Being Born. It's sort of like transcends the subject matter, right? Mm-hmm. It's always about in some way like lifting the veil. And you're like offering people this like glimpse of like truth, and you're connecting them back to something that like, yeah, I knew that in my soul. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You know, babies are supposed to be born like this, or we are supposed to heal with plants. We are supposed to heal with nature, you know? And then you have like these moments. I mean, like last night, it was the most emotional thing. At the end of the movie, we realized that there was a family who had seen Ricky hosting, guest hosting on The Talk.
A TV show on TV.
The CBS show. They had heard her talking about the movie. They had looked it up, found the website, seen when it was opening in LA. They drove 6 hours with their dying child to be at this movie last night.
Wow.
To meet us, to meet the parent. Like, and I've, the desperation, I can't even just begin to describe it to you. And, you know, and people were lined up also after the movie in New York last week. I've got people's personal phone numbers texting me, just looking for medicine, looking for doctors, you know. And it's the same thing, I feel like, after we did The Business of Being Born. It was like people were bombarding us, you know. But I had this horrible birth and they cut me open and I want to have another baby, but I can't go through that. Help me. Can you find, you know. And so it's like ultimately it's like you're, I don't know, it's like you're just – it sounds crazy, like you are like literally changing lives.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. So in order to give the most people the chance to see it, where can they see it Friday night?
It's playing here in Los Angeles at the Lemley North Hollywood for a week starting Friday.
Great. And then in New York?
In New York, it will be
this might be the last
finished
day.
Yeah, yes. It'll be finished at Cinema Village. But we also have a big screening in Berkeley.
Okay.
A one night only this Saturday night that Ricky and I will be at, and also a one day only in Sebastopol on Sunday.
And between now and April 20th, yeah, when it premieres on Netflix, they can do private screenings? They can through the website? How
well,
does that work?
Well, they should look at the website because okay, we've got theatrical. We've got it opening in Chicago, in right, Seattle, in San Francisco, in Boston, in Baltimore, in Philly. I mean, some of them are only one night showing.
Got
so
it.
You just need to check the website and see where it's playing.
Well, congratulations, you guys. This
Thank
is an amazing
you.
Thing you guys did. And I'm an Academy voter, so you guys have at least one vote in the bag. Good luck with that. And thank you guys so much for doing this. And thanks for coming in.
It's
Ricky, it's so great to
so
see you.
So good to
I'm
see
sure
you.
I'm sure I'll see you a couple more times. And nice to meet you. This has been amazing,
too,
guys.
Tom.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right on. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger. I used to host the Art of Charm podcast, but now it's time for something new. The Jordan Harbinger Show. Did you know you can be entertained and actually get a boost in your life at the same time? On this show, we dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers and top talents. Then we deliver them to you right into your ears. But I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint so you can live what you listen. After 1,000 interviews, learning 5 languages, and getting arrested in a country that doesn't even exist anymore, I'm now more ready than ever to introduce you to The Jordan Harbinger Show. Listen free to The Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app.